2. Measuring progress in Afghanistan. How should the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, track progress in the Afghan campaign? How should coalition capitals and headquarters assess performance? What should subordinate organizations assess and report to determine whether the mission is on track? Why metrics matter. This analytical chapter offers some thoughts on measuring progress in Afghanistan. It draws on my experience working in or on Afghanistan since 2005, on a broader understanding of metrics in counterinsurgency, on observations from fieldwork, and on input from Afghans and internationals, civilian and military, currently in the field. Given the fluidity of the war, however, this chapter is merely a snapshot of developing thinking on a highly complex set of issues. In 2009, in Afghanistan, ISAF seems to be in an adaptation battle against a rapidly evolving insurgency that has repeatedly absorbed and adapted to past efforts to defeat it, including at least 2 previous troop surges and 3 changes of strategy. To end this insurgency and achieve peace, we may need more than just extra troops, new resources, and a new campaign plan. As General Stanley McChrystal has emphasized, we need a new operational culture. Organizations manage what they measure, and they measure what their leaders tell them to report on. Thus, one key way for a leadership team to shift an organization's focus is to change reporting requirements and the associated measures of performance and effectiveness. As important and more urgent, we need to track our progress against the ISAF campaign plan, the Afghan people's expectations, and the newly announced strategy for the war. The U.S. Congress, in particular, needs measures to track progress in the surge against President Obama's self-imposed 18-month timetable. To be effective, these measures must track 3 distinct but closely related elements. 1. Trends in the war, that is, how the environment, the enemy, the population, and the Afghan government are changing. 2. ISAF's progress against the campaign plan and the overall strategy, including validation, whether we are doing the right things, and evaluation, how well we are doing them. 3. Performance of individuals and organizations against best practice norms for counterinsurgency, reconstruction, and stability operations. Metrics must also be meaningful to multiple audiences, including NATO commanders, intelligence and operations staffs, political leaders, members of the legislature in troop-contributing nations, academic analysts, journalists, and, most important, ordinary Afghans and people around the world. We should also note that if metrics are widely published, then they become known to the enemy, who can game them in order to undermine public confidence and perpetuate the conflict. Thus, we must strike a balance between clarity and openness on the one hand, and adaptability and security on the other. Shared diagnosis. Because we need to track so many things for so many people, a shared diagnosis, a vision of what the nature of the conflict is and what is driving it, is essential. Neglecting this diagnosis risks a situation where analytical staff are drowning in data, lacking a clear conception of what matters and what does not. They collect on everything, creating a mass of disparate data that makes tracking progress harder. By definition, any assessment changes as the conflict develops, but it is essential to maintain a common set of core metrics, as well as to maintain a consistent methodology so that second-order effects and trends can be analyzed over time. This is not the only possible analysis. Other ISAF and coalition analysis products provide substantially more detail and rigor, and their analysis differs somewhat from this example, but it illustrates the type of simple diagnosis that is needed. Note that this is a gross oversimplification, like any model of any conflict, but it needs to be this simple so that it can be understood, remembered, and carried in the head of every district stabilization officer, company commander, police mentor, development professional, diplomat, and intelligence officer. District Stabilization Analysis. Most NATO headquarters are organized along Continental Staff System lines, with sections for operations, intelligence, personnel, logistics, communications, and so on. Mirroring this headquarters layout, campaign plans are organized along logical lines of operation, LOOs, LOOs. Typically, in counterinsurgency, these include security, development, governance, rule of law, and essential services, among others. This is not the best way to manage the Afghan campaign, because LOOs can create stovepipes. Each LOO team tends to focus on its own issues, and teams may lack adequate working-level mechanisms for the combined planning and execution that are essential for carrying out the work of stabilizing districts. Reducing identified local drivers of violence and instability. This lack of such mechanisms in turn creates a tendency to dissipate effort in non-strategic activity. Everyone on the headquarters knows what the district's basic problems are, but it is nobody's day job to fix any given problem. Responsibility is fragmented across multiple groups, each of which owns part of a problem but lacks the authority or the sense of ownership to solve it. Stabilizing the district becomes everybody's job and therefore nobody's. There is a tendency to place the burden on senior commanders, expecting them to deal with this through a commander's intent that is supposed to unify efforts across LOOs. The problem is that real-world commanders, no matter how brilliant, simply lack the bandwidth to master the intensely detailed nuances of each local problem, map these to multiple LOOs, and then coordinate across multiple agencies, many of which they do not control, to generate unified action. In practice, and understandably, since insurgents kill our people daily while unemployment and corruption do not, on a minute-by-minute basis, most military commanders prioritize kinetics, fighting the insurgents, and deal with other issues mainly through periodic, weekly or monthly interagency reviews. In doing so, they tend to treat or even exacerbate the symptoms of instability while neglecting its causes. In contrast, our field team's experience with units that deployed in the mid-2009 troop augmentation, including the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade and the 5th Stryker Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division, and with the Office of Transitional Initiatives in Afghanistan of the U.S. Agency for International Development, suggests that a different approach, sometimes known as district stabilization analysis, may be more effective. This approach is a three-stage process of assessment, triage, and audit, after which the unit involved creates integrated issue teams to manage priority stabilization targets. In the assessment phase, the unit conducts an analysis to map all the grievances, issues, and problems across a particular district, aiming to identify the main drivers of violent conflict. Since this is Afghanistan, the assessment typically results in a lengthy list of problems, many of which are long-standing, intractable issues that simply cannot be fixed by outsiders. In the triage phase, the unit selectively reduces this list down to a priority action list by identifying problems that meet the following three criteria. 1. The problem is actually, currently driving instability that creates Afghan-on-Afghan violence in the district in question. 2. The insurgents are actually, currently, exploiting the problem in order to increase the strength, reach, or public appeal of their movement within the district. 3. ISAF can make a meaningful, sustainable contribution to resolving the problem in a viable time frame, 18 months to 2 years, within current resources. This triage process typically results in a much reduced list of 2 to 3 priority problems in each district, representing issues that have strategic impact and that the unit can also do something about. Problems that both matter to the population and are fixable by us in a meaningful time frame and within existing resources. In the final, audit phase, the unit reviews all its activities, development spending, security effort, key leader engagement, direct action against high-value targets, partnering and mentoring, intelligence collection, and so on, against these priority problems. In many cases, units doing this operational audit for the first time discover that their efforts have been dissipated in attempts to solve numerous grievances that do not matter, cannot be fixed, or would take too long or need too many resources. Often, they also find that the attempt to deal with multiple grievances simultaneously has both raised and disappointed community expectations over time, creating a credibility gap in the minds of the local population. The audit process allows units to redirect effort onto identified priority stabilization targets and begin to rebuild local partnerships. Redirecting this effort involves organizing for success. Rather than stovepiping along LOOS, the unit can tiger team around identified stabilization targets. This is done by forming multidisciplinary stabilization teams, STAB teams, one for each priority issue, with one individual in charge of each team who has the personal, day-to-day responsibility to track and deal with that issue. Staff sections contribute to these STAB teams just as they do in any integrated planning process. Rather than having stovepiped teams for security, development, rule of law, and so on, the unit forms a team for each identified driver of conflict. For example, a corrupt sub-district governor, an influential local Taliban court, or a capable bomb-making cell, and allocates a representative to each issue team from the security, development, rule of law, essential services, and intelligence sections. This is not the only workable method. For example, Canadian forces in Kandahar have recently experienced considerable success with their key village approach, using specialized STAB teams that focus on identified priority grievances in key local districts lying astride the main insurgent approaches to Kandahar City. Whatever technique is adopted, the critical thing is that the unit should develop a shared understanding of the key drivers of conflict in its area of responsibility, form a unified issue team to deal with each driver, and make one individual responsible for working each issue. This is where, as the campaign develops, developing common core metrics to match this methodology come into their own. Common core metrics. Metrics in this sense are observable indicators, detectable events in the environment that indicate progress toward or away from identified goals. Because consistency over time is important, a small number of enduring key indicators is better than a large number of frequently changing indicators. Ideally, assessment staffs are looking for surrogate indicators that allow them to detect deeper trends in the environment that may not be directly observable. They are also looking for clusters, indicators that tend to occur together and, taken in context, can be interpreted together to generate a picture of overall trends. Interpretation of indicators is critically important and requires informed expert judgment. It is not enough merely to count incidents or conduct quantitative or statistical analysis. Interpretation is a qualitative activity based on familiarity with the environment, and it needs to be conducted by experienced personnel who have worked in that environment for long enough to detect trends by comparison with previous conditions. These trends may not be obvious to personnel who are on short-duration tours in-country, for example. Metrics that can be deceptive and therefore should be avoided include 1. Body count. At the start of a conventional engagement, if we are facing 100 of the enemy and we kill 20, we can assume that 80 are left. In counterinsurgency, this logic does not hold. The 20 killed may have 40 relatives who are now in a blood feud with and are obligated to take revenge on the security forces who killed the 20, so the new number of the enemy is not 80, but 120. Of course, it is impossible to know whether this is or is not the case, so body counts tell us little about overall enemy strength. Moreover, body count data are notoriously corrupt and subjective, with differing interpretations of insurgent versus civilian casualties, and are open to being gamed by the enemy or by corrupt security force units who might deem killed civilians posthumously to be combatants. 2. Military accessibility. The ability of a security force unit to move from point A to point B within its area of responsibility. The level of weaponry, size of force, and number of combat engagements required to conduct a given move changes over time, depending on the security situation. But overall, this indicator is problematic because it depends on the enemy's desire and willingness to engage us. If a unit always gets into firefights in a particular area, we can assume the presence of active hostile insurgents there. But the reverse is not the case. Absence of armed opposition does not indicate lack of enemy presence. The enemy may simply be choosing not to fight, for reasons ranging from lack of numbers to lack of popular support, or conversely, a desire to protect pro-insurgent local populations, to the fact that the enemy may use the district as a rest area or logistic base, or may have the objective of organizing the population in that area rather than fighting the security forces. 3. SIG acts, especially those involving violence against the coalition. These are often used as a surrogate metric for overall progress, on the assumption that more SIG acts are bad and fewer SIG acts are better. This is understandable, but again problematic. Violence tends to be high in contested areas and low in government-controlled areas, but it is also low in enemy-controlled areas, so that a low level of violence indicates that someone is fully in control of a district, but does not tell us who. In 2010, we will insert approximately 37,000 extra troops into Afghanistan, on top of 20,000 in 2009, so by definition, SIG acts will be higher, since there will be more troops engaging in combat. There will also be an observer effect. Not only will more combat actually occur, but also we will have more eyes out on the ground observing and reporting violence. Thus, almost certainly, violence involving the coalition, actual and reported, will rise in the next year. But this higher violence level will not in itself tell us whether we are winning or losing. 4. Dialogue with the enemy. Our Afghan interlocutors have discussed with us in detail their way of war, which includes regular contact with enemy leaders, via telephone, via letter, or face-to-face. This occurs partly because people across all factions of the insurgency and the government side are related to each other, have common district or tribal ties, and know each other well. Because many families have members on both sides, and because, in Afghanistan, warfare is normally accompanied by direct messaging. Unlike us, Afghans do not necessarily stop talking to the enemy when they start fighting. Most conflicts end when one group switches sides or agrees to surrender. Thus, the mere fact that our local partners are in dialogue with the enemy is not an indicator in and of itself of disloyalty to the government. 5. Any single numerical metric. Numerical indicators tend to be misleading because quantitative data is so difficult to collect and verify in Afghanistan. Numerical indicators include body counts, incident counts, SIG acts, and numbers of Afghan police or soldiers trained. Numerical indicators are essential, but they must be carefully interpreted in the context of other quantitative data, along with a qualitative, political assessment of conditions in a given district. 7. Any input metric. Input metrics are indicators based on our own level of effort, as distinct from the effects of our efforts. For example, input metrics include numbers of enemy killed, numbers of friendly forces trained, numbers of schools or clinics built, miles of road completed, and so on. These indicators tell us what we are doing, but not the effect we are having. To understand that effect, we need to look at output metrics. How many friendly forces are still serving 3 months after training, for example, or how many schools or clinics are still standing and in use after a year, or better still, at outcome metrics. Outcome metrics track the actual and perceived effect of our actions on the population's safety, security, and well-being. This matters because in counterinsurgency, if we want the population to cease supporting or tolerating the enemy, we need to make them feel safe and convince them that they are better off siding with the government than with the insurgents. Note that they not only have to be safe, they must also feel safe, or they will not be motivated to choose the government side. Thus, popular perceptions are critical, and these cannot be tracked through measures of our input alone. More useful metrics. Metrics with greater utility can be divided into four categories, based on the four key factors in any counterinsurgency: the population, the supported host nation government, the security forces, military and police, and the enemy. A selection of possible metrics includes the following. Population-related indicators. Voluntary reporting. The number of unsolicited tip-offs from the population in relation to insurgent activity can indicate the level of popular confidence in the Afghan security forces and willingness to support the government. This indicator must be verified by assessing the percentage of tip-offs that prove to be accurate. A low accuracy level may indicate that the population is hedging, trying to placate the security forces with inaccurate information, or using the security forces to settle scores with local rivals by denouncing them as insurgents. Percentage of reported IEDs that are actually found. Reporting of IEDs is an important subset of the voluntary reporting metric, because accurate reporting indicates that the population is willing to act voluntarily to protect the security forces. These devices account for roughly 50% of ISAF casualties in Afghanistan, yet approximately 80% of IEDs that are discovered, as distinct from those that explode, are spotted simply because someone, often an Afghan, sees the IED on the side of the road and tells someone. Variations in the percentage of Afghan-originated IED reports that are accurate may therefore correlate with variations in levels of local support for ISAF and the government. Price of exotic vegetables. Afghanistan is an agricultural economy, and crop diversity varies markedly across the country. Given the free market economics of agricultural production in Afghanistan, risk and cost factors, the opportunity cost of growing a crop, the risk of transporting it across insecure roads, the risk of selling it at market and of transporting money home again, tend to be automatically priced into the cost of fruits and vegetables. Thus, fluctuations in overall market prices may be a surrogate metric for general popular confidence and perceived security. In particular, exotic vegetables, those grown outside a particular district that have to be transported further at greater risk in order to be sold in that district, can be a useful telltale marker. Transportation prices. Again, Afghanistan's trucking companies tend to price risk and cost, the risks of insurgent attack, IEDs, kidnapping, or robbery, and the costs of bribes, kickbacks, and other forms of corruption into the prices they charge for transportation on the country's roads. Thus, variations over time in the price for transporting a standard load on a given route can indicate variations in the level of public perception of security and of corruption and criminality along that route. As with all other indicators, variations over time are more significant than the price on any particular day. Progress of NGO construction projects. Numerous NGOs are engaged in construction projects across Afghanistan, using local materials and labor. Unlike government projects, which the insurgents may attack on principle, NGO projects tend to go well when they have access to low-cost materials and an adequate labor supply, and tend to suffer when costs rise due to insecurity. Thus, NGOs running multiple projects at different points across the country may have a fairly clear idea of security conditions and confidence levels, based on the degree of progress in their projects. Influence of Taliban versus government courts. Taliban mobile courts operate across much of the south and east of Afghanistan, providing dispute resolution, mediation, and Sharia-based rule-of-law services to the local population, and making judgments that are enforced by local Taliban vigilante cells that operate much as insurgent police. Rule of law and local level governance has developed into a major insurgent focus over the past 2 years. Public willingness to seek, accept, and abide by judgments from Taliban courts may indicate popular support for the insurgents, or it may simply reflect a default choice in the absence of an alternative. For example, in districts where there are no local government courts, most of the south, or where traditional tribal courts have been displaced. The Taliban court's range of movement and the volume of cases being brought to them, considered in comparison to the volume of cases being brought to local government courts, may indicate whether the population sees the government or the insurgents as fairer, swifter, or more able to solve their problems. Rate of participation in programs. More generally, both the government and the insurgents run a range of community programs, economic programs, and political activities that seek popular participation. The rate of participation in these programs varies over time, both between villages and within the same village. While it is generally difficult to gauge participation in enemy programs with great precision, participation in Afghan government or coalition programs is easier to track, and may indicate the degree to which the local community perceives the Afghan government as a legitimate actor with the ability to address its problems. Tax collection. A classical counterinsurgency metric is the rate of taxation compliance, specifically the population's rate of compliance with the government's taxation programs versus that with the insurgents' taxation system. The insurgents operate a robust, predictable taxation system across most of Afghanistan. The government does not. It collects hardly any taxes at the local level. By contrast, corrupt officials and police collect illegal tolls and taxes at checkpoints. In this situation, a three-way comparison is needed that takes into account the effects of the insurgents' taxation, where a high degree of local compliance indicates a high degree of insurgent control, of the government's taxation, where the emergence of any fair and predictable system would represent an improvement in government effectiveness, and of the illegal extortion, which indicates the level of corruption of key local officials and may correlate to popular rage and discontent. Afghan-on-Afghan violence. Unlike statistics that track violence against the coalition, the amount of Afghan-on-Afghan violence, whether the cause is insurgent action, the actions of government officials and security forces, or criminality, is a good indicator of the level of public security. In areas where there is a high level of Afghan-on-Afghan violence, the population is very unlikely to feel safe enough to put their weapons down and join in peaceful negotiation or support for the government. Likewise, a spike in Afghan-on-Afghan violence in a particular area probably correlates to a drop in public confidence. Rate of new business formation and loan repayment. The number of new local businesses being formed each month, along with the rate of loan repayment to local moneylenders, can be an indicator of public confidence and economic growth. In Afghanistan, the rate of small business formation is typically low, while the rate of repayment is usually fairly high. Both indicators, however, fluctuate in line with availability of capital and confidence in the future of Afghanistan. These indicators also tend to vary markedly between urban and rural areas, and the contrasting numbers may serve as a measure of how public perceptions differ in the cities and larger towns compared to smaller villages. The urban-rural divide is a long-standing social cleavage in Afghanistan, one the Taliban has exploited in the past and is worth tracking closely. Rate of new starts on urban construction, especially residential housing and markets. Especially in urban areas, this rate can be an important surrogate indicator of the level of popular confidence in the future. People who lack a sense of security and an expectation that the future will be better than the past tend to be less willing to invest in major construction projects. As with other indicators, fluctuations in the rate over time may be more telling than the absolute number in any given area at any one time. Percentage of local people with secure title to their houses and land. Land reform is a long-standing issue in many parts of Afghanistan. Land ownership was a major flashpoint in the Soviet-Afghan War and back into the 19th century and earlier. In many areas, corrupt power brokers exploit complicated land disputes. The Taliban have at times acted as mediators and sought to resolve these disputes justly in order to further their influence. At other times, they have deliberately exacerbated and exploited land disputes in order to gain the allegiance of local people who are party to a dispute. A key element of public confidence and perception of stability is having secure title to land and other property. Therefore, the percentage of people in a given district who have secure title to their property can be an indication of stability, whereas a large number of unresolved or power-locked land or title disputes can indicate potential for instability and insurgent exploitation. Host nation government indicators. Rate of assassinations and kidnappings of local officials, tribal elders, district notables, and ordinary people. This rate can be an indicator of instability in a district. For example, a province that is experiencing frequent assassinations of local sub-district governors, police officials, or other government representatives, or a high turnover of local people in positions of authority, may be experiencing a concerted insurgent push to displace or destroy a local elite. In general terms, a high rate also indicates a high degree of instability, even in the absence of overt insurgent activity. On the other hand, a low assassination or kidnapping rate does not necessarily indicate that a district is pro-government. A district that has a low assassination rate, produces low levels of voluntary reporting, and has a low violence level may simply be an enemy district that is stable under insurgent control. Civilian accessibility. As already mentioned, military accessibility is not a good indicator of insurgent activity. Civilian accessibility is a better one. If local officials are unable to travel or work in a given area or must do so with an escort, if they are frequently kidnapped or assassinated, or if the local population avoids an area, this tends to indicate insurgent or criminal presence. Even in the absence of insurgent violence directed at coalition or Afghan security forces, no-go areas for civilian government officials tend to indicate a high degree of insurgent control. Where local officials sleep. A large proportion of Afghan government officials currently do not sleep in the districts for which they are responsible. District governors may sleep in the provincial capital, while some provincial governors sleep in Kabul or in their home districts in other provinces. In some cases, when a local official does not sleep in his assigned district, this may indicate a lack of security and high threat, in which case the district is likely to be heavily insurgent contested or even insurgent controlled. In other cases, the official may sleep with his own kin group in a different district out of personal preference, indicating that he may be acting as an absentee governor or may have been appointed as an outsider to control the district rather than representing it. In either case, the official in question is less likely to be seen as legitimate and effective by the local population. Thus, changes in this indicator may indicate changes in local perceptions of the government. Officials' business interests. It is often useful to map officials' business interests and those of their relatives and tribal kinship groups, ownership of companies, bids for coalition or Afghan contracts, control of local production resources, against incidents of violence and unrest in districts for which they are responsible. Determining these interests can be difficult, though the local population usually knows them, but can be revealing. Incidents of violence against USAID construction projects, for example, may be insurgent-inspired, or may simply reflect the efforts of an official who owns a rival company to undermine a project with a view to eventually taking it over. An official whose tribe or family is a party to a land or water dispute, or who has business interests in a particular piece of land, may also be an illegitimate broker in the eyes of the local population, who may turn to the Taliban for relief. Likewise, officials who engage energetically in counter-narcotics operations, but simultaneously own substantial poppy fields in other parts of the country, may simply be eliminating their rivals' crops to further their own interests. A district-based Register of Officials' Assets, regularly updated, can therefore be a very useful tool for interpreting incidents of violence. Percentage of officials purchasing their positions. Many local government officials in parts of Afghanistan gain their official positions through an informal and illegal system of patronage and nepotism, where they purchase their positions for a substantial sum, paid to a higher-level official, often a relative. This system creates incentives for corruption, since these officials must now recoup their investment through extorting money from the population and may have to pass kickbacks to their patron. They have essentially purchased a license to exploit, and over time, government positions come to be seen as opportunities to fleece the population rather than to serve Afghanistan. Obviously, this creates enormous opportunities for the insurgents to exploit. In a given district, therefore, a high percentage of officials owing their positions to the illegal purchase system tends to correlate with a high degree of corruption and may correlate with the population having a more than normal willingness to collaborate with the insurgents. Rate of budget execution. How much of their allocated budget line ministries, provincial and central government officials, and local councils are actually able to spend is a potential indicator of the degree of government effectiveness. Districts where allocated funds are being spent in a timely manner are more likely to be receiving an adequate level of government services. Local officials are likely to be more capable managers. The absorptive capacity of the local economy is likely to be higher, and corruption may be lower. Conversely, districts that do not execute their budget effectively may be suffering from poor quality officials, lack of economic capacity, and a lesser degree of essential services. Coalition units may also be at fault. The tendency to dump Commander's Emergency Response Program, SERP, funds on underperforming districts through block grants can generate the appearance of a short-term quick fix, but can also have an addictive effect that causes local officials to sit on their own funds while letting the foreigners spend, and may create habits of dependency that ultimately undermine the effectiveness of the local economy. Capital flight. During the period of intense uncertainty in late 2009, as Afghans anxiously awaited the U.S. decision on which strategy to select and whether or not to reinforce the effort, we saw millions of dollars leaving Afghanistan on a weekly basis as Afghans shifted their assets outside the country in expectation of instability and possible civil war. When this type of behavior spikes, this may indicate a significant lack of confidence in the future and public uncertainty. Changes in the rate of capital movement outside the country may track closely with changes in public confidence, hence in the credibility and legitimacy of Afghan government and international community efforts in the eyes of local elites. Rate of formation of anti-insurgent lashkars. Districts that are opposed to the insurgents but also distrustful of the government tend to have a high rate of formation of lashkars, tribal or district fighting groups that seek to protect the community against all comers. Thus, the formation of anti-insurgent lashkars in a given area may indicate that the population distrusts both the government and the insurgents and is a possible indicator of swing voter behavior or autarkic a plague on all your houses attitudes on the part of local community leaders. Public safety function. The side that performs the public safety function, protecting the population from crime and violence, tends to be seen as the more legitimate and effective. Given the high level of police corruption and abuse in some parts of Afghanistan, many of our interlocutors scoff at the idea of going to the police for protection. By contrast, the Taliban have been carefully building a reputation for swift and harsh but fair punishment of criminals and for protecting local people from abuse. The Taliban's published legal code, the Layiha, binds both Taliban units and populations to a set of standards enforced by local Taliban cells. In Kandahar and some other centers, the Taliban maintain a public safety hotline, akin to a 911 call center, that local people can call in an emergency to confirm or deny Taliban involvement in an incident or to seek Taliban assistance. These behaviors, coupled with a moderate to high level of abuses by local officials and police, may indicate that the local population sees the insurgents as more legitimate and effective than the government in a given area. Security force indicators. Kill ratio. Ratio between kills inflicted and kills suffered. Whereas raw body count is a poor indicator, this ratio can be a useful indicator of a unit's level of confidence, aggression, and willingness to close with the enemy. However, in assessing this metric, it is essential to control for civilian casualties, escalation of fire incidents, and other possible indicators, discussed below, that a given unit may be engaging in brutality or abuse. Kills resulting from indirect fires, artillery or mortars, or airstrikes or kills by supporting coalition units also do not count. The only data relevant to this indicator are confirmed kills and/or captures directly inflicted by the unit in question on positively identified insurgents actually engaging in combat operations. As with many metrics, the absolute number of kills or captures at any given moment is less important than second-order data relating to trends over time. If a unit's kill ratio is improving, this may indicate greater confidence, better dominance over a given area, better intelligence, and possibly a closer relationship with local populations. But, like other indicators, kill ratio must be interpreted in relation to other data before this can be known. Ratio of wins to losses. At the most general level, units that consistently win their engagements, inflicting more losses than they suffer, retaining possession of disputed ground, and protecting key population groups, are usually performing better than units that consistently lose. In practice, however, most security force units win most engagements against insurgents, so that changes in the win-to-loss ratio over time are more significant than the absolute proportion of wins to losses. Again, in calculating this ratio, it is essential to control for engagements won due to artillery and/or air support or coalition force intervention, as these do not count in assessing the unit itself. Ratio of kills to wounds and/or captures. In a standard combat engagement, for every one enemy killed, analysts usually expect to see 3 to 5 enemy wounded or captured. This is, of course, simply a general guideline, but some Afghan security force units consistently kill 4 or 5 enemy to 1 wounded or captured. This abnormal kill-to-wound ratio bears closer investigation. It may be that the enemy always fights to the death, or that Afghan units have a remarkably high level of marksmanship, though field observation and anecdotal evidence suggests neither of these is the case. It may also be that these units are relying on air power and artillery, and that this is generating this anomalous ratio. Alternatively, a kill-to-wound ratio of 4 or 5 to 1, rather than the normal 1 to 3 or 5, may indicate that units are engaging in extrajudicial killings or deeming dead civilians posthumously to be enemy. There is insufficient evidence at this time to be certain, but as an indicator of possible security force brutality, This needs to be closely tracked. Ratio of guilty to innocent detainees. The proportion of individuals detained who, on subsequent investigation, turn out to be closely, genuinely linked to the insurgency. A unit that has a low detainee guilt ratio may be arresting lots of local military-age males, but if most of these are innocent, it can be having a sharply negative effect on local support and may even be producing insurgents, as innocent detainees become radicalized in temporary detention and families become radicalized through the unwarranted seizure of their young men. Conversely, a unit that has a high detainee guilt ratio is detaining mainly individuals who are genuinely linked to the insurgency, and this is a surrogate indicator that its intelligence is of high quality. Its methods are showing appropriate restraint, and it is probably gaining the confidence of the local population by developing a reputation for accuracy and effectiveness. Ratio of recruitment to desertion. In general, when an organization's recruitment rates are higher than its desertion rates, morale can be said to be functionally adequate. When desertion rates rise, along with other indicators like increased sickness rates and short-term absences without leave, organizational morale is likely to be dropping. The rate of short-term absence without leave is not a reliable indicator in itself, however, because in countries like Afghanistan, where recruits have little or no access to a banking system, they tend to go absent without leave after payday to take their pay home. Proportion of ghost employees. Some Afghan military and police units have a proportion of ghost employees on their books. In most cases, these are fictional employees whose pay the unit commander claims from higher headquarters, but then puts aside for his personal use. While this practice is unlikely to be stamped out anytime soon, the proportion of ghost employees in a unit and the way this proportion changes over time may indicate the degree of corruption of the commanders concerned. It does not necessarily indicate poor morale. It may do so if unit members feel they are being exploited, but in some cases they see the practice as legitimate. In a society without robust social security or veterans' pensions, some units use ghost employees to create a pool of funds that go to the welfare of incapacitated police or soldiers and the families of those killed in action. Location at start of firefight. Every firefight in Afghanistan is played out in front of an audience and has a political and military meaning in the eyes of that audience. Afghan elders frequently call coalition commanders at the end of an engagement in order to offer their play-by-play commentary on a firefight that has just ended. One of the key elements in how the population interprets a firefight is the location of opposing forces. For example, if security forces are located in a population center, standing with the population at the start of an engagement, and the enemy attacks down from the hills, then the population frequently seems to interpret the insurgents as the aggressors and the security forces as their protectors. Thus, even if the insurgents win the firefight, they may lose politically by pushing the population into our arms. Conversely, when security forces attack into a village or valley, even if acting on solid intelligence, the population sometimes perceives them as the aggressors and may side with the insurgents. This is especially so in night attacks, surprise attacks, or engagements in remote terrain where rural populations are traditionally suspicious of strangers. If a unit is consistently located in close proximity to protected populations at the start of firefights and consistently wins those firefights, this may indicate that the unit is gaining credibility and legitimacy in the eyes of the population. Escalation of fire incidents and civilian casualties. Units that consistently get involved in escalation of force incidents, where troops fire on civilians who fail to stop at roadblocks, drive too close to convoys, or otherwise appear threatening, or are responsible for significant numbers of civilian casualties, may have an overly aggressive attitude to the local population and may be placing too little emphasis on protecting civilians. They may also be overly nervous and frightened of their environment and hence trigger happy. Almost certainly, units that frequently kill or wound civilians lack a close relationship with the local population, lack viable local partners, and lack a good information network, making them more vulnerable to insurgent attacks. Duration of operations. Single-day operations, in which a unit sleeps every night in its fortified base and only goes out in the daylight, tend to indicate lack of confidence, lack of energy, or the existence of a tacit, or possibly even explicit, live-and-let-live deal with the insurgents. Single-day, large-unit sweep operations, daylight search operations, cordon and knock sweeps, or short-duration raiding operations may also be having a negative effect in their own right. A unit that consistently conducts multi-day operations that last for up to several weeks and lives in its area of responsibility rather than merely visiting it tends over time to develop a closer rapport with the local population, becomes more familiar with local enemy groups, and protects its population while dominating its area more effectively. Night operations. If a given unit frequently operates by night or stays out for several nights on operations, this may indicate that the unit is dominating its area of operations, is confident in its environment, and has the upper hand. In particular, if night operations tend to be protective, for example, ambushing potential enemy routes used to infiltrate population centers and intimidate government-aligned population groups, then they may contribute to a popular feeling of safety and normality, and hence may bring the local population to the government's side. On the other hand, if night operations are aggressive, for example, raiding, hard-knock search operations, use of airstrikes and indirect fire to deny areas to insurgents, they may actually contribute to a feeling of insecurity on the part of the population, and hence may have a destabilizing effect on the district. Small unit operations. Units that mount a larger number of smaller unit operations, at squad, platoon, or company level, depending on the local threat profile, tend to cover a greater area within their area of responsibility with greater thoroughness. Willingness to conduct multiple small unit operations also indicates a greater degree of confidence and an expectation of defeating the enemy if encountered. Combined action operations. Operations involving combined action, where coalition units intimately partner with local military, police, civilian authorities, and coalition civilian agencies down to the small unit level, tends to indicate improved performance by all partners in the action. Coalition forces tend to perform better because they have access to local knowledge, language skills, and situational awareness. Local military forces can access coalition fire support assets, intelligence, mobility, medical support, and other enablers, and have a constant professional exemplar in the presence of coalition troops. Local police are relieved of the burden of direct combat with main force insurgents and can focus on their policing role, and they are constantly monitored, reducing the risk of corrupt or abusive behavior. Local and coalition civilian authorities and agencies are able to operate in higher threat environments as part of a combined action team, giving them greater reach and endurance, better protection, and the ability to demonstrate responsible leadership and deliver essential services to the population. Dismounted operations. If a unit frequently operates on foot, this may be an indicator that it is more confident in its environment, has greater reach across its area of responsibility, much of which, in Afghanistan, may be out of reach of the road system, and has a better rapport with local populations. Anecdotal evidence and data from other campaigns suggests that units that operate dismounted may also be less vulnerable to roadside IEDs, though this has yet to be confirmed in the Afghan context. Conversely, units that always operate from the supposed safety of roadbound armored vehicles may be predictable, due to always following a limited number of roads, may be easily ambushed, and may lack rapport with the population, which may see them as alien, strange, or cowardly. The roadside IED is clearly a military weapon, but it is also a political weapon the insurgents use to separate the security forces from the population. Dismounted operations can redress this separation. In practice, due to the size of Afghanistan and the lack of friendly troops, almost all operations commence with a road or air move to a jumping-off point from which units may proceed dismounted. Furthermore, the positive effects of dismounted operations may improve the relationship between the unit and the population across its whole area of responsibility, not just in the actual areas where it operates dismounted. Driving behavior. The driving style of a unit, whether drivers push civilian vehicles out of their way, whether they wait their turn in traffic, how aggressively they force civilian cars back from convoys, whether or not they illuminate passing traffic with laser sights, whether they hog the center lane of the road or drive in lane, is a good atmospheric indicator of a unit's attitude toward the population and hence of the population's likely attitude toward that unit. Units that drive rudely, alienate the population, and disrupt traffic and commerce with aggressive driving techniques usually have poor community rapport. Reliance on air and artillery support. If a unit relies too heavily on airstrikes, artillery and mortar fire, and other forms of non-organic support, that is, assets not owned by the unit but rather called upon through higher headquarters, in most of its engagements, this may indicate lack of confidence and unwillingness to engage with the enemy or the local population. It also creates conditions that may lead to increased civilian casualties or collateral property damage, as the unit is employing area weapons that it does not control, rather than organic direct fire weapons. This tendency can be assessed by comparing the size of units engaged in a given series of combat actions with how often they call on non-organic fires. If a unit consistently draws on indirect fire even when engaging much smaller enemy groups, it may have a confidence problem. Conversely, if the unit regularly gets into situations where its small units encounter large enemy groups and have to be rescued by indirect fire, it may be overreaching or may be overmatched in its area of operations and require reinforcement. Pattern setting and telegraphing moves to the enemy. Units that set patterns, always moving on set routes, always leaving or entering bases from the same direction at the same time, selecting the same overwatch positions on patrol after patrol, or developing standard ambush positions or observation posts, tend to become more vulnerable to insurgent ambushes, IEDs, and attacks. Likewise, if a unit has a tendency to accidentally telegraph its moves to the enemy, for example, by always massing helicopters in the same way before a raid, it may be more vulnerable to being outmaneuvered by the insurgents. On the other hand, deliberately telegraphing moves to the population is often appropriate in Afghanistan. Even the Taliban rarely move from one valley or village to another without seeking community permission, and coalition units can message local populations, "We are coming into your valley next month. You have 10 days to expel the enemy from your villages, or we will be forced to mount a clearance operation," in order to force the enemy to move without fighting. This does not always work, but it is a technique that is familiar to Afghans because it is often used in their traditional forms of conflict, and it may have a positive effect in some circumstances. Possession of the high ground at dawn. The Afghan campaign, in addition to being a counterinsurgency, a stabilization operation, and a competition for governance, is also a classic mountain warfare campaign, especially in Regional Command North, East, and some parts of Regional Commands South, West, and Capital. Thus, the basic tenets of mountain warfare tactics apply, including control of the high ground, maintenance of wide fields of observation from key terrain, dominance of peaks overlooking key routes, ability to bring plunging fire onto identified enemy positions, and ability to move on the high ground at night. Units that consistently hold the high ground at dawn tend to demonstrate a mastery of this form of warfare, whereas units that are consistently overlooked by the enemy at first light tend to struggle in this environment. Enemy indicators. High technology inserts. The Taliban are generally a low-tech guerrilla force, but they do possess and deploy some high-tech capabilities: satellite phones, accurized weapons, sniper optics, and in some parts of the country, high-tech components for IEDs. Presence of these high-tech inserts in a given insurgent group may indicate that it has access to better funding or greater support from external sponsors, and such a unit is more likely to be a full-time main force Taliban column rather than a local, so-called Tier 2 guerrilla group. Insurgent medical health. The health of insurgent detainees from a given area is also an indicator of the nature of the insurgent organization in that area. Local guerrillas tend to suffer numerous health problems, ranging from malnutrition through malaria, tuberculosis, leishmaniasis, and other parasitic diseases to diabetes, respiratory tract infections, and other chronic health problems. Their health problems tend to track those of the local population in a given area. Main force units, on the other hand, often have a better general level of health, and insurgents based in Pakistan or directly sponsored by external agencies may have received inoculations or other medical support. In both cases, the healthier an insurgent, the more likely he is to have received external assistance. Presence of specialist teams and foreign advisors. Some Taliban main force units work with specialist teams, snipers, heavy machine gun and mortar teams, rocket teams, specialized reconnaissance teams, intelligence teams, media propaganda teams, and so on. Some also often include foreigners, that is, of non-Afghan origin, and occasionally foreign advisors, usually Pakistani or Central Asian in origin. The presence of these specialized teams, and especially of foreign advisors in a given district, may indicate that a main force enemy column is working in that district. Insurgents' village of origin. The difference between insurgents who originate from villages within the same district where they fight, local guerrillas, and those who fight outside their district of origin is extremely important. Local guerrillas are often part-time fighters, frequently switch sides in the conflict on the basis of local, tribal, or economic motivations, and more generally are part of the fabric of local society. If a security force unit is to stabilize a given district, it needs to defeat these local guerrillas, but it must also emphasize their reintegration, reconciliation with them, and winning them over. After all, they represent key members of the society the unit is trying to stabilize. Thus, attempts to destroy local guerrillas outright can backfire by alienating communities and can create blood feuds that perpetuate the conflict. On the other hand, insurgents who operate outside their district of origin, or even originate from outside the country, can be deemed foreign fighters in the eyes of the community. They often lack tribal ties or rapport with the community and should be targeted with maximum lethality as ruthlessly as is legally permissible. As a foreign body within local society, these fighters can be killed and captured intensively, as long as targeting is accurate and avoids innocent civilians, without disrupting our relationship with the locals. Indeed, local communities may actually feel safer and may partner more closely with units that ruthlessly target foreign origin insurgents while seeking to reintegrate and reconcile with local guerrillas. First to fire ratio. Percentage of firefights in which our side fires first. This ratio is a key indicator of which side controls the initiation of firefights and is a useful surrogate metric to determine which side possesses the tactical initiative. If our side fires first in most firefights, this likely indicates that we are ambushing the enemy or mounting pre-planned attacks more frequently than we are being ambushed. This, in turn, may indicate that our side has better situational awareness and access to intelligence on enemy movements than the insurgents, and it certainly indicates that we have the initiative and the enemy may be reacting to us. Most important, the side that initiates the majority of firefights tends to control the loss rate, and this can be checked by mapping insurgent losses against which side fired first in the engagements where those losses were suffered. If the insurgents are losing most of their casualties in firefights they initiate themselves, then they are in control of their own loss rate and can simply stop picking fights if their losses become unsustainable and restart operations once they recover. If they are losing most of their casualties in engagements we initiate, then we control their loss rate and can force them below replenishment level and ultimately destroy the network in question. Price of black market weapons and ammunition. Afghanistan has a substantial black market in weapons, ammunition, explosives, and other military equipment. As in any other free market, the price of weaponry on this black market reflects supply, availability of weapons, and demand, the rate of arming or rearming among population groups, and the insurgent requirements for weapons to support their operations. Thus, price fluctuations over time, especially in standard weapons such as Chinese or Romanian AKs, or in commodities such as 7.62mm short AK rounds, can indicate changes in insurgent operational tempo, an increase in community demand due to insecurity, or a drop in supply due to improved interdiction. Ratio of surrendering insurgents to those killed and/or captured. A larger number of defectors, deserters, or surrenders on the part of an insurgent group may indicate a drop in that group's morale. Conversely, unwillingness to surrender, fighting until killed or captured, on the part of insurgent fighters can indicate high motivation. Analysts can seek indications of an insurgent network's morale by comparing changes over time in the insurgent kill and/or capture rate with changes in the insurgent surrender and/or desertion rate. These ratios should also be considered in relation to the insurgent recruitment and retention rate. If an insurgent group's loss rate is high, but it has no difficulty obtaining local recruits, then it is likely to be experiencing a high degree of local support. Mid-level insurgent casualties. The insurgent's loss rate is also a useful indicator, especially in relation to losses in the middle tiers of the insurgent organization, the level below the senior leadership group, comprising planners, operational facilitators, technical specialists, trainers, recruiters, financiers, and lower-level operational commanders. Killing senior leaders may not actually damage the insurgency particularly, especially if senior leaders who are killed or simply replaced by younger, hungrier, more radical, and more operationally experienced leaders from the next generation. Likewise, the insurgents can and do expect to lose a significant number of foot soldiers and to replace them relatively easily with minimum disruption. On the other hand, killing or capturing the insurgent middle management tier can do significant damage to the organization while leaving senior leaders intact and perhaps even convincing them over time that their campaign is futile and without killing large numbers of lower-tier fighters and sympathizers who may be good candidates for reintegration. Thus, the insurgent loss rate at the middle level of the network is an especially important indicator of the network's health and resilience. Tentative conclusions. Tracking progress in counterinsurgency is notoriously difficult, and in a complex and fast-moving campaign like Afghanistan, with dozens of actors on all sides and numerous interested parties, it is even more problematic than usual. Nevertheless, in order to react effectively to changes in the enemy and the environment, or ideally to preempt enemy actions and gain the initiative, we must measure progress. In the war itself, against the campaign plan, and against recognized norms of best practice counterinsurgency and stabilization operations. This chapter has presented a selection of core metrics along with key indicators and some thoughts on assessment and conflict management methodology. Like any other set of thoughts on the campaign, these ideas draw on a long history of counterinsurgency thinking over the past several decades, as well as more recent experience in Afghanistan. They were also out of date the moment they were written down. As in any other endeavor in counterinsurgency, the challenge for commanders and assessment staffs is to remain agile, seeking not to template previously useful metrics, but to constantly develop and apply new indicators based on a shared diagnosis of the nature of the conflict and what is driving it. These indicators must track developments in the four basic elements of the campaign: the local population, the host nation government, the security forces, and the insurgents themselves. And they must be carefully interpreted, applying judgment and qualitative reasoning rather than simply counted.